Well, as promised earlier in the program, we're about to talk about possibly the largest and most diverse group of Aboriginal elders and leaders together in one place at one time, crowding into Alice Springs to attend a two-day meeting. Now, a little while ago, there was an Aboriginal protest march during the G20 in Brisbane. Unsurprisingly, the Australian flag was burnt, but perhaps surprisingly to my listeners, effigies of Mundine, Langton and Pearson were also torched, and there is a connection between that event and the event we're about to discuss. Organisers for the Summit for Freedom see their gathering as an opportunity to, quote, reclaim our rights to represent ourselves, because in each of our homelands, in our communities, we are facing issues and threats that alone we cannot fight, we cannot improve. But together, if we stand as thousands, then we can. Now, joining me to discuss this are three of the most outspoken advocates for Indigenous people, three of the country's most respected Aboriginal elders. In our Alice Springs studios, Rosalie Kenneth Monks and Torto Sansbury. Rosalie is an Arunda elder, former actress, nun, political advisor, environmental campaigner, interpreter, and the 2015 Northern Territory Australian of the Year. Torto is a Noongar elder, consultant, proprietor of Gurindja in South Australia, delegate to the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples, chairperson of Noongar Nations and deputy chairperson of the Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement. Another deep breath, and in our Darwin studio is the legendary Michael Mansell. Michael is a Padawa elder, barrister, activist, former chairman and legal manager of the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre, secretary of the Aboriginal Provisional Government, and the 1987 Aboriginal of the Year. And I welcome the three of you to our little wireless program. But first of all, those official CVs really don't tell us an awful lot. So I want to ask each of you to give me a potted biography of your real lives as opposed to your official lives. Michael, what's your story in brief?
I didn't enter the Aboriginal political movement until the early 1970s when Gary Foley, Paul Coe and the Sydney Blacks set up the Aboriginal Legal Services. And it seemed to me when I first heard about it, this was an outlet for preventing police walking into our houses in Tasmania. Once I got involved, the issues were fairly obvious. You know, in Tasmania back in those days, we're only half castes, not real Aborigines. So I thought, well, here's an issue. So I was one of the people who took it up, especially a fair-skinned, blue-eyed Aboriginal, to confront Tasmanians and say, well, the solution that you thought you had didn't work and we're still here and we've got rights to land. And so it sort of generated from there. And I eventually got involved in the national scene, then gained some notoriety by going internationally to pariah states and was cast as a terrorist when I came back to Australia, and I think it was around late 1980s. And sort of drifted back to Tasmania after the native title negotiations with Paul Keating in 1993. And eventually we got land rights in Tasmania in 1995 through to 2003. So that sort of occupied my involvement.
You're the sort of Aboriginal that Andrew Bolt doesn't like, aren't you?
He's written a number of things to make the point.
Okay, Torto, tell me your story.
Oh, my story is I started working back in 72 for the Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement in Adelaide. I spent 10 years as the national chair for the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, which was the Aboriginal Justice Advisory Body. I've spent a good 40 years now working, doing what I am doing now, and I've done a lot of things in South Australia and a few things at a national level, but I mean, this is one of the biggest things that I've ever done, along with Michael and Jeff Clark when I gave them a call. But you know, I'm a little bit older. I'd now sing the song, Now I'm 65,
I don't regard that as older. You're a teenager.
I'm a teenager still working till I'm about 70.
Rosalie, you're on paper, you know, everything from nun to actress. What's your story?
My story, I guess, is that I was born a black person in Australia. What has transpired since then to make First Nations people the political football it is today and something for people who are bored to play with has kept me, I guess, in the centre of this. At the age of 16, of course, as everyone knows, I didn't audition for it. I was picked to act in the film Jetta, which was the first feature-length colour film in Australia. Thus, along with Albert Namondjira and several other people, like the lead in Jetta, Mr. Tadawali, we were put for everyone to look at, to prod and kind of just poke around. We weren't supposed to have the feelings of other humans of paler skin. Ever since then, for 77 years, for your information, Mr. Adams, I have been there. Not because I wanted it, but because I was put there. In becoming more politically aware while spending time in Victoria, I, of course, then came back to find out who the hell I was, and I did, and much to my joy and delight, I am still connected onto my tribal lands, which I or my people have never ceded, and I'm still there.
I think that's been a very useful way to introduce this. Now, Torto, one of the organisers of the Summit for Freedom, Michael's telling me off air that although it seemed to me that it had been put together in rather a hurry, you've been thinking about it for a while.
I have. Well, with all the problems that we've had in South Australia and the lack of the South Australian government, which is Labor, to negotiate and talk to Aboriginal people, I woke up one morning and I thought about it, and I said to my partner, I'm going to make a couple of phone calls because I think we need a summit. And so I rang Michael and Jeff Clark and bounced it off of them, and they said, let's go for it, brother. So I said, yeah, okay then. So I then rang Jerry Georgiadis, and he put it in the National Indigenous Times, wrote it up and everything, and we're here today. And look, this all came about because I'm not happy with what's happening at a federal level, the way the federal government is, as Rosalie said, using us as political footballs, taking our land away, the eye suicide rate that you mentioned, the eye incarceration rate, and all of those issues that are totally being ignored, and now removing Aboriginal people off their land is totally unacceptable to me, and I think many of the people that are coming.
And Torto, there's also an estrangement between you, Mundine, Langton and Pearson.
They don't talk to me.
At all?
Well, Mundine came to Adelaide and he said, I'll come back and have a meeting with you and your community. Unfortunately, he didn't come back. Langton, no, and Pearson, no, also. And I think for us, they're more of a liability to us than an asset. So, they become the object of our frustration. They'll become the object of our discussion in Alice Springs over the next 2 days. And I hope they become the object of a removal at the end of the day.
Michael, one of the repercussions of these fracture lines is that it totally confuses the left. What's left of the left who've been trying to say and do and think the right things on Aboriginal issues forever. So do you agree with Torto's view?
Slight variation on it. My view is that if you want to have an opponent who is your real problem. It's not Marcia or Noel or Warren Mundine. It's the government. The governments are the ones who control whether Aboriginal people get land. The governments are the ones who have very weak heritage legislation in the country that allows development at all costs. And even in South Australia, I saw that an Aboriginal graveyard had to be dug up and moved out of the way just so people could have drive their cars across some six-lane highway. They could have easily moved the highway. And, of course, the real issue is after 226 years, we still have a white person deciding Aboriginal policy for Aboriginal people. And so my focus is on the opponents who, in that case, really are the government. I acknowledge that many Aboriginal people get frustrated that the single voice that we hear is the right-wing conservative voices from North Queensland who tend to blame the victims for the problem. And I acknowledge that, but I think as long as we keep our focus on where the issues really have to be resolved, and that is with the federal government and the state governments, then I think this summit could come up with something that could, for the first time in a decade, change the agenda and make the agenda one that Aboriginal people agree with.
Rosalie, given the fracture lines and given the complexity and given the depth of the problems, do you think that you'll be able to get consensus?
I don't think we're about forcing people to have a consensus. The fact is that in First Nations Australia, there is a pain that I'd not witnessed before. And that pain is so plain, it comes out through the suicide of our young people, it comes out of family infighting, it comes out of the substance abuse which people perhaps use far too much. This is where it's at. And this is what we need to do to get together and first and foremost to heal ourselves. It's very easy for me to say I did not enjoy the appearance of Mr. Pearson on Q&A because he was more right-wing than any right-wing in Australia last night. And that's not what I'm looking for as a black person. First and foremost, I must remain faithful to who I am. I can't be anything else. I'm a black woman with my traditions and my customary practices still just clinging on by the skin of our teeth. And that's where we need to go. Who are we? First of all, find ourselves. Don't crawl your way because the policy says we are not acceptable in Australia unless we are speaking the most pristine English, unless we have got clean nails. And also, we have to be willing and ready to be placed by the system into where the government policy says we have to be. There is a black Australia. Let's reclaim that.
It's interesting, isn't it, that you and I are having this discussion, Rosalie, at a time when the West Australian government has announced their intention, or their desire at least, to close down a great number of remote communities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is a crime, as far as I'm concerned, against human rights. And that's where we need to not contemplate our own navels in isolation. We need to get together, see what other people are suffering. And that's where we need to go. Forest River Mission, Umulgari, I think, has devastated a lot of people not only within the community of Western Australia, but across Australia. Now they're talking about demolishing anything, even sacred sites, for the sake of mining or whatever. But there is a plan in place, and we need to be aware of it.
This is Ellie Nell on RN, and we're discussing the First Nations Summit for Freedom. And my guests, Rosalie Kernoth-Monks, Tato Sansbury, and Michael Mansell. Michael, how are you funding this?
Everybody's getting there under their own steam. Because one of the problems is that the federal government's funding conditions prevents Aboriginal organisations, who used to be an outlet for the political expression and the aspirations of Aboriginal people, to be able to meet at the national level on topics other than those agreed to by the federal government. So what that indicates is over the last decade or so, we have been completely outmanoeuvred and we've lacked the resources to change it. And when you talk about West Australia, Phil, I mean, that's a classic example. You've got the West Australian government that would have funds to provide electricity, water supply, sewerage, roadworks, housing for many people in Western Australia, including Aboriginals and non-Aboriginals. But as soon as Canberra cuts the budget back, the only people that West Australia says it will cut off are Aboriginals. Now, that is racist, because they're going to continue the funding for non-Aboriginal people. What they should be saying is, well, look, the pain's got to be spread across the board, and it's important that Aboriginal people be able to maintain their connection on the land. And just as Australian policy says, look, whenever the farmers are in drought, we throw $50 million in their direction to keep them on the land, why shouldn't that policy also apply to Aboriginal communities in Western Australia?
Toto, given the financial constraints, how many people are you really expecting to turn up?
Well, I'm hoping to see around 150, 200 people plus. I've had a lot of calls from around Australia since the summit was announced, and it was going on again last night. But, yeah, as Michael has said, you know, everybody is concerned about this, so everybody is funding their own ways, finding their own ways. And, you know, there was a question put to me that I was getting around $100,000 to put this summit on. And I'm glad that I came to Alice Springs early, because I had to speak to the people that were talking about that and said, no, there's no money attached to this at all, and this is an Aboriginal agenda. So, you know, this is how concerned Aboriginal Australia is about this. And when you're talking about those being removed from Western Australia, it's now been identified that South Australia is going to remove something like 3,000 people off their land.
I'm glad you've made that point, because Weatherall has also had to echo Barnett, and this makes the point that because federal funding has been cut, they'll have to close.
Yeah, and the whole thing about that is Weatherall and Ian Hunter has failed to really communicate that to the Aboriginal community of South Australia. They're very, very slack in approaching and talking about Aboriginal issues. So, you know, as Michael said earlier, Pat, it is the state and federal governments that we're concerned about, and that's one of the reasons why this came about. In relation to what I said about the three other Aboriginal people that are involved, I mean, they have a very lot to say, and they're listened to by those people in politics, and it's very hard for us to get our word and our message through and our point of view. But
Toto, quite a few white fellas are backing you, of course, like my old friend Fred Cheney, who's quite horrified by this policy.
He is, and Ian Viner sent a letter to me in relation to the 99-year leases and what's going to happen. The Ed lease will stay at Parliament or stay in Canberra for the rest of its life, and Aboriginal people will lose their land and not get it back. So there's been a lot of people. The Australian National University in Canberra has sent me 15 reports in relation to the Andrew Twiggy Forest review. So there has been a lot of good non-Aboriginal people that are starting to provide a lot of information about what is wrong in Australia.
I want to move on to some other topics in a minute, but Rosalie, if these tiny communities are closed down, it'll break the hearts of the people, won't it?
it'll actually bring on the death throes of the existence of the First Nations people. We will be then museum pieces that you can read from libraries and so forth. We will still carry the colour of our skin, but we will become a carbon copy of mainstream Australia. We will be utilised for tourism and for other curios, but nothing more than that. We will then become a lost people. And the lands, without the lands, who are you? We're nothing.
You know, I'd forgotten, Rosalie, that you were involved in Jeddah, a film that I remember very vividly and, of course, at the time had a huge amount of impact. But from that time to this day, you seem to feel that your people are very often used merely for decoration.
Absolutely. I make no apologies about saying that. And the more we claw our way to become like a carbon copy of the white people, we are losing the essence of us, black Australians.
Michael, what about the viability of tiny remote communities? What's the argument?
Diversity is something that is an asset of a nation, and it shouldn't be seen as a liability. Also, when you consider that the roots of the people who are in those tiny communities goes back more than the five or six generations that Europeans talk about, we're talking about people's roots going back to when time began. And so there's something very precious about that. And it just seems to me that if the Australian government purchased one less warplane, it could help these communities stay where they are. If the government increased or decreased the fuel subsidies to big companies like Rio and BHP by 1 cent, that would fund those Aboriginal communities. And why shouldn't those people be able to access federal funding the same as other people in Australia access federal funding? And I know that people in the cities get all the infrastructure paid by state governments when they put their hand out for the excess GST funding at COAG. Well, that money should be spread across also to these outlying areas where Aboriginal people just simply don't want to give up their traditional land areas. And why should they have to give it up?
Let's move the focus now onto another subject which absolutely confuses people of sympathy. And I'm talking, of course, of the Northern Territory intervention. Rosalie, what has it done to your people?
Absolute trauma. It caused pain. We were all declared pedophiles. We had these huge blue signs saying the first big words in capital was beware. And I thought I'd grown an extra head and that I was breathing flames of fire. It was disgusting, absolutely disgusting. And it still is in, what's the other word? Something about the future anyway. These things were made in isolation to tribal Aboriginal people out in the bush. The day they arrived out at Utopia, I never forgot it, because they were in uniform, the army. They had their shining cars. It was like something out of a nightmare. And also the police came out there. I think they had revolvers and they rounded us more or less into the basketball stadium. And we were told we had to change our ways. I don't know what they meant by that, but the policies had changed, I guess. And from there was real terror on communities. Mutitjulu, I think, was the other one that suffered quite a bit. But so did Yuendumu, so did Papunya, so did everyone else. Now, to keep on going along this line and still no apology, there were no pedophiles in the extent they said there were. There is pedophilia all over the world, but it does not start and begin with First Nations people. There might have been, because I've worked as an interpreter in both the petty sessions and the Supreme Courts in Alice Springs, and I did not see the extent of pedophilia, which was bandied around to all and sundry within Australia to dehumanise us, to demonise us. That is unforgivable, and I believe the government owes an apology to the First Nations people.
Rosalie,
that's where
Rosalie,
I become angry.
I agree with you about the pedophilia charges. What do you say, however, about violence towards women?
Violence towards women were happening maybe in the same thing as it was happening in hidden homes throughout Australia, under the influence of substance abuse. It certainly was not happening on my community. Nobody's allowed to hit their wives or to even mentally torture them, because we live closely with each other and the lineage of family groups does not allow that.
You know, it's interesting, Rosalie. I wrote a column for The Australian saying exactly that. I did a tour of local magistrates' courts on what's known as Ladies' Day, when women, largely almost entirely women, come along to the magistrate to get orders out against, violent partners. And I made the point that it was a huge social problem right throughout Australia. And to my astonishment, The Australian ran an editorial attacking me and my column. If I can go to you on the same subject, please, Michael. I know you live a long way from the intervention, but what conclusions have you come to about its outcome?
What concerned me, Philip, was that there's no doubt that the intervention was being drawn up as part of a political campaign leading to the 2007 election, and at that time there was a very weak Labor opposition, a very strong government led by John Howard, who wanted to portray the Labor Party as being weak on sexual issues or violence in Aboriginal communities. I mean, that was the motivation behind it. What I did see, though, in the fallout was that the Australian media almost played the role of the propaganda wing of the John Howard government. And it made me realise that when the Northern Territory intervention took place, which portrayed Aboriginal people as pedophiles, rapists, bashers of women and neglecting of children, that this was the day that democracy let Aboriginal people down. We had no power to intervene, to say no. There was no access to the media by people like Rosalie or other Aboriginal people who disagreed with the decision. It was going to be done whether Aboriginal people liked it or not. And I know that it was interesting, the discussion between you and Rosalie about violence in Aboriginal communities and alcohol. Of course we've got that in our communities all around the country, but so too do white people. But the government would never send the army in against its own citizens in white communities. It only did it with Aboriginal people. And I think what this does show is that there's got to be a discussion, which no doubt will come up in the national meeting. How do Aboriginal people control our own destiny? How do we get decision-making about our interests and our aspirations back in the hands of Aboriginal people and away from the white politicians?
Torto, your turn. I'd like you to give me some observations on the intervention.
Well, I took a lot of notice of Mal Brough and how he sold it to the media, to the community, to the politicians, I was quite concerned. I actually went in to many meetings and I sat down and listened to people, and as it's already been said, you know, that there was a huge pedophile ring in Aboriginal communities in outback Northern Territory and also the APY lands, and they found nothing there, yet they still carried on their merry way. And as it's already been said about Michael, we had no opportunity to tell our stories to the media. Mainstream media didn't want to listen to it because it sold a lot of papers and made people like Rupert Murdoch a lot more money, while, you know, they criticised, victimised and ostracised Aboriginal people to the point that, you know, this summit has come about because this is going to be a major discussion about that. One of the things why, you know, I suggested that we have the summit in Alice Springs is that we open that, you know, the intervention started here, let's try and finish it here.
Rosalie, let's look at something else. The government-initiated Twiggy Forest Review, creating parity. One of the proposals is a healthy welfare card, and this goes further than the current income management in Aboriginal communities, and that's to remove all cash from welfare payments. Is there a good case for this?
I don't believe there's a case at all. If they want to try it, I mean, where did Twiggy Forrest get his expertise on Aboriginal people from? I believe, just going aside from that, if I may, I believe this summit will set the tone of where the First Nations people want to go. And I'll say it strongly and I'll say it clearly now. The sovereignty of each nation of First Nations people here has never, ever been ceded. It's been taken by force like anywhere else where colonisation has taken place. But here we have not even entered into dialogue in the same language. A few chosen people, such as our Mr. Pearson, such as our esteemed Professor Langdon, they're saying things without even touching base with the people that are hurting, people who are losing their 9-year-old kids hanging themselves, 19-year-olds, 17-year-olds. This is not a game or a Greek tragedy. It's real life being played out. And this summit, I say thank you very much to Torto, and I say thank you to Michael Mansell, and I say thank you to Jeff Clark. Thank you for bringing it into the heart of our black nation. Let's be serious about it, and let's not quote either the propaganda from the government or from those spokespeople. What they are trotting out seem to be real, but it sure ain't the truth. We now want to discover the truth, and we do not look for money. We look for the strength of the people of this nation. And that goes for black and white. I challenge people to bring back the quality of life and to look at humanity rather than at where the politicians want you to be at.
In the few minutes we've got left, I want to raise another topic, which I must say in this heat of battle seems almost irrelevant, but I've always thought it was of crucial importance, and that's about recognition in the Constitution. Michael, where is this at? Has this campaign run out of puff?
I think so. Gary Foley, an old campaigner, you know, from New South Wales and Victoria. You'd remember him, Philip.
Oh, Gary and I go way back, yeah.
he's terrific stuff. He made a point that really struck a chord with me. He said, this is an absolute distraction. He said, who cares if we're mentioned in the Constitution? We want to deal with other issues. And it made me appreciate that already in Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia, the state constitutions give recognition to Aboriginal people, yet it's made absolutely no difference. the constitutional proposals they're talking about do not create any rights for Aboriginals, nor does it impose any obligations on governments. So one is left with the question, why on earth are we wasting time on this? Why aren't we instead, which is probably going to come up at the National Summit, why don't we start talking about revival of the Bob Hawke proposal for national uniform land rights legislation? Because 90% of the Aboriginal population in the country is still dispossessed or separated from ownership of their lands.
Okay, we're running out of time. Torto?
Yeah, I'd just like to say something in relation to the Andrew Twiggy Forrest report. His mandate, he went far outside his mandate that he was asked to do. It was only in relation to employment and training. In relation to recognition, and as Michael has already said, yeah, we're already in the Constitution down in South Australia, and I went to the reading of that. And again, you know, we'd like to include you in the Constitution. We acknowledge all the pain and suffering, the death and and what we've taken away from you. But unfortunately, there's no compensation attached to it. So, yeah, it gave us nothing, and I think the federal Constitution will do the same.
Rosalie?
I already have a Constitution that is unwritten. I will not go into a foreign constitution.
That's a very blunt statement.
And it's meant to be.
Okay, one final issue, and I can only put this to you, I think, Michael, and that is that many elders believe that we're being fast-tracked for another land grab by this government and by some of its industrial friends.
There is concern, Philip, across the top end of the Northern Territory with the development that Aboriginal people that already have land or have got land claims are going to be pushed completely out of the way for development. So there are these activities going on, but there's no national conversation about it. And one of the problems with, some of our colleagues in the Northern Queensland area is that they get all of the discussion, which is all about blaming the victims, and yet there's no discussion on the very points that you've raised here and which should be spread out over, a couple of weeks.
Well, I found this discussion emotionally exhausting but absolutely fascinating, and I thank the three of you very, very much for contributing. The legendary, might I say, notorious Michael Mansell, activist, barrister, Rosalie Kunath-Monks, 2015 Northern Territory Australian of the Year, and Torto Sansbury, who's the deputy chairperson of the Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement. And the three of them have come together with others for the First Nations Summit for Freedom. It's on in Alice on Thursday and Friday this week, and we shall stay in touch. Now, on our next, I'll be talking to Bruce Shapiro, who'll be discussing the fallout from today's decision by a US grand jury not to indict a white police officer over the fatal shooting of Michael Brown, the black teenager, in Ferguson, Missouri. And we'll also be talking about the complex issues behind the recent fatal attacks in Jerusalem, and we'll be discussing crime and punishment in Mexico. Time for the news on RN, and I'll talk to you again in 23 hours.